Courtney Edwards is a former psychotherapist turned behavioral health coach. As the owner of Alchemy Coaching and host of the Pragmatic Alchemy podcast, Courtney blends her background in psychology and counseling with the practical framework of coaching to help folks invite more mindful well-being into everyday life. After earning her MS in counseling from Pace University, Courtney continued her professional development by earning a board-certified coaching credential from the Center of Credentials and Education, certified relationship coach from IAP Career College, and certified meditation teacher from Aura Wellness. She brings more than 25 years of experience into their helping professionals working with adolescents, college students, adults, couples, and families. Additionally, Courtney is an adjacent instructor at the CACREP accredited counseling education program at Sunny New Paltz. She lives and works in New York's Hudson Valley with her family. Thank you, Courtney, for joining us today on the Tutor Revolution podcast. I'm super excited to learn more about your journey, more about your knowledge, some really interesting things we're going to discuss today.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So Courtney, transitioning from psychotherapy to behavioral health coaching is such a significant shift. Can you share what inspired this change in your professional journey and how it shaped your approach to wellness?
I think probably it was like the reverse order. Like my approach to wellness changed, and then that changed the way that I want to do this work. So I had gotten my master's degree almost 17 years ago now in counseling and working specifically with mental health, and then was working as a psychotherapist when my kids were little. Left that for a little bit. I've also had kind of a parallel career in college student affairs for the last 25 years or so. So I spent probably about a decade doing that and then came back into wanting to work with clients, wanted to establish my own practice. And in that decision-making process and in that planning, came to realize that in the 10 years or so that I was away from mental health, my perspectives on what is or is not pathology, what is the root of the concerns that people are bringing into therapy, had really shifted. And specifically, moving away from this kind of medical model, pathologized viewpoint of human problems. I think our psychotherapy world, largely because of outside forces like health insurance reimbursement and state licensing boards, has shifted counseling into more of a more akin to like psychology. And when I was getting my master's degree, counseling was a lot more like what coaching is now, which is centered on this viewpoint that ultimately you're fine over the course of your life. Sometimes things go a little sideways and you need some support to sort of right the ship and get back towards your the best version of yourself. And that's what counseling was when I signed up for it. And then in, you know, the last 15, 20 years, it's really shifted. And I didn't make that shift with it. I wanted to stay more into this alignment of humans are generally okay and just sometimes get a little bit stuck. And I want to help people get unstuck.
Yeah. So you don't have to diagnose someone with just a code of like an illness that they may or may not have. And that's kind of almost puts a stigma on their perception too.
Right. And I look around at the world and to me, I almost come away with this idea of if you're not anxious right now, I'm actually a little more concerned about you. Like things are really hard. And, you know, particularly since, you know, 2020, but even before that, there's just been a lot of stuff going on in our current society that I think really does cause challenging circumstances, and that what we're calling depression and anxiety and bipolar disorder and all these other named illnesses really is just a human response to some adverse challenges. And so I want to move that idea of there's something wrong with you to maybe the circumstances you're confronting right now, you just don't have the coping skills for, or your nervous system is activated, or you've had these attachment wounds in childhood, but that it's more that something happened to you versus there's something wrong with you.
That's such a great point. And I think that helps people heal quicker when they don't feel like there's something like a stigma that's attached. Right. To them. Like I have anxiety disorder or I have depression or bipolar or something. Whereas it's like, okay, what's the result for that?
Right. Right. You know? Right. And I also think, you know, to that point too, I also, one of the things I really love about coaching is that it's very forward focused.
Yes.
It's very active. And so as a psychotherapist, I would spend so much time with clients trying to ask or answer the question of why, you know, why am I like this? How did I get this way? Which I just don't find to be an effective way to spend our time because there's not one reason, you know, it's almost like there's no reason. And there's also a million reasons. And we could spend decades trying to parse that out and maybe not ever get anywhere where coaching, or at least my type of coaching, comes at it saying, this is where you are. Let's just name that and then ask the question, what do you want to do about it? As opposed to getting really stuck on this question of how did I end up like this? Because I don't know that there's an answer.
Yeah, okay. That's kind of what our approach to coaching is like. We don't keep you in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Like the past
exactly.
Is the past. There are certain things you need to know, maybe to be able to release that. But then we're gonna move forward. You
yes.
can't stay in the past. You're never gonna make progress in that. So
that's exactly how I view it. You know, and I think that you can still take steps to heal those old wounds, but to make that the sole focus, I don't find that to be effective.
And it almost makes like clients more of a victim.
Mm-hmm. Like, it can. Yeah.
Yeah. Victimizes them more instead of getting them out of the victim into you. Yeah. A healthy.
Yeah. Like mindset. A place of empowerment. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've emphasized the importance of mindfulness in everyday life. Can you explain how you integrate mindfulness practices into your coaching sessions and the impact it has on your clients?
Sure. So I think it falls in line with a lot of what we were saying, which is this, you know, really focused on just kind of telling the truth of our experiences. So when I think about mindfulness, so a lot of my training in meditation and mindfulness has come from a Buddhist perspective. So there are elements of that, although I don't always bring that piece of it into the coaching because it's not something that everybody's into. But there are some fundamental concepts that I've taken from that Buddhist tradition that really focuses on kind of telling the truth, accepting what is as it is, right? Because I think so much of what we struggle with is this idea of it shouldn't be this way, or I don't want it to be this way, or I want it to be some other way. And then we just kind of get stuck in those cycles of, just sort of like just rejecting what is true in favor of what we would prefer. And that is a core tenet in Buddhist philosophy. And in that framework, it would be called, you know, rejecting or grasping or clinging. And where I see that play out, you know, in kind of modern life is, you know, people on their phones or people using substances or all these ways that we kind of numb out mm-hmm. to the things we don't want to experience, or we're chasing the dollar to try it. We think that's, you know, the key to happiness. If I just make more money, if I just have a better job title, if I, you know, just whatever things we put on our list. And what I really want to encourage people to do is really just kind of be here in the present, tell the truth about what is happening and accept it with an open heart. Because from there, that's where I think we can make positive steps towards the things that we would like to see change in our life. I don't think wanting to see change in our life is a bad thing. It's that idea of when you get so stuck in the rejection or the clinging of the present moment that you used to, you know, you can really start spinning your wheels. I think back when I, you know, early adulthood, I always was plagued with this idea of like, I'll be happy when. I'll be happy when I get a different job. I'll be happy when I get married. I'll be happy when we live in a bigger house. I'll be happy when I lose 10 pounds. I'll be happy when my kids are older. Like, and what I have found, you know, I went through a divorce about 10 years ago. And what I found in kind of the second half of my life is be happy now. And all the rest of that stuff is going to find its way into your life. But it's about really saying, I'm good, right? there are definitely, I have goals, things that we want to do and things that are important to me. But I also know that right now in this moment, there's a lot of peace and contentment. And that feels like a very powerful place to then start making other decisions.
Yeah, it's like when you're looking, you know, typically we're almost taught to look into the past or the future.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no like being present. And that's actually one thing I personally put on my 2024 vision goal, you know, is presence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Total presence, being present at the moment and just eliminating. Cause you know, you have like depression to me comes from past.
Yep.
Anxiety is future.
Yep.
So if you can take those two and be present, that's, to me, that's joy and happiness, you know? And
I agree. I agree 100%. And I think one of the things I learned in my own life is that this pursuit of happiness is a little bit of a bait and switch, right? I just, you know, I could go on a capitalist rant for a while. I won't. I'll just say that we live in a society that is always dangling some kind of shiny thing in front of us saying, get this, pursue this. The key to all of your problems being resolved is in this shiny thing.
Yeah.
And we call that happiness and we're chasing it. And what I have found in my own life, and this is largely rooted in my mindfulness practice, is that what I'm hoping to achieve is completeness, wholeness, just feeling whole and complete within myself, because then I don't need to chase the shiny thing. And it's almost like from that's grounded, centered feeling of I'm whole and complete, all just as I am, just like this, imperfect as it is, I can now be open to receive happiness instead of pursuing it. And that feels so much more fulfilling than, you know, the hustle and the grind and the I'll be happy when statements.
Yeah. Cause then when you get to those points, it's like looking for the next thing.
That's right. There's always something more.
The next thing, you know, and it's always, it's more, 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 more. And again, like you said, true happiness really comes within yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. I believe that to be true.
Yeah. Great points. So coping with and preventing burnout is crucial in our fast paced world, as we kind of talked about. What are some effective strategies you've recommended to individuals and groups to manage stress and avoid burnout?
Yeah. So this is such a big topic in my work right now. And it's really exciting to me as I've transitioned the way that I approach working with folks. I have adopted this really strong framework of well-being. And so kind of idea of mindful well-being, it's the tagline of my podcast. It's a huge undercurrent in the work I do. And a lot of that came through COVID, actually. Moved into the counseling or the coaching space, as we talked about, from psychotherapy, but still had a little bit of a hard time losing that counselor identity of we're, you know, fixing things that are wrong. And in, you know, kind of the height of COVID, when people were really scared and businesses were shutting down and people were losing their jobs and kids were remote learning and parents were scrambling and everybody was really struggling and had a lot of racial reckoning in our country and some other things. And I could just see all of this pain and this distress, and also could recognize, like, I can't counsel this away for anybody. Like, it's too pervasive and it's too big. And to kind of like come at it and say, you know, we're going to counsel through this, like, that just felt absurd to me. And so, you know, I can just remember sort of sitting there and regrouping and be like, well, then what can I offer people? If I can't take this away for them, what can I offer them? And what I sort of landed on was I can help people figure out how to bring more mindful well-being into everyday life. And so that's this idea of bringing in more good. It's not going to make the bad go away, because we can't always make the bad go away. And I've actually learned to now embrace that as a really powerful truth of, okay, so we're not going to make the bad go away. Who said that we needed to? Right? Like, who said we need, right? Like, who said we needed perfect conditions to be happy? Let's sit in the muck and be happy anyway, you know? And so So that really shifted the way that I started doing my work away from like, let's kind of solve this problem to let's just counter the hard stuff with some good stuff. I use a lot of tenets of positive psychology. I find it to be a really exciting field. There's a lot in positive psychology that does mirror coaching. So it feels very it sort of merges those two parts of my training together. So focusing on strengths, on positive emotion, positive relationships, what are the good things that you already have going on for you? Let's just sort of bring those to light. And then I use a lot of the framework of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So when people are asking me, you know, how do I cope with stress? The first thing I say is get real familiar with Maslow's hierarchy. If you can start meeting some of the questions in that hierarchy, I think you're going to put yourself in a good position. So are you eating, right? Are you nourishing your body? Are you sleeping? Are you hydrated? Are you moving? Do you have a safe place to keep your body, you know, and really just looking at that kind of foundational stuff. Now, do you have relationships in your life that are reciprocal and fulfilling? You know, do you engage in work or activities that feel fulfilling and align with your values? Do you have a spiritual practice? Again, just kind of going up that hierarchy and looking at when we can meet those needs, we can then build sort of this toolkit and this resilience to face all of these big, huge societal woes that we can't just quite make go away with the snap of our fingers.
Yeah. So you really have to get down to the basic needs.
Yeah.
Your basic needs are met. You can't move up to the next one until you are doing the basic things.
Yeah.
And the great thing is those are majority of us, especially in the United States, for instance, we can change those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a lot of capacity to do
habits,
that.
We can change our sleep habits. We can change all the things that we're not giving ourselves. So these are our basic needs that most of us have access to. And so once we hit that portion, then we can move up to the next.
That's right. And one of the things I really love about that model is that it requires mindfulness.
Yeah.
Because you have to be paying attention. You have to be paying attention to your body. Am I tired? Am I hungry? Right? Like I can feel a little hunger pang. Is that hungry or is it bored or is it dehydrated? And by using mindfulness, which I sort of identify as just being awake in your own life, you can start to pay attention to those things. You know, if you start to spend time with people in your life more mindfully, you might recognize which relationships don't serve you quite as well. Or you might start to recognize what people really calm your nervous system and that those relationships feel really replenishing and nourishing and good. And so all of it is just, you know, kind of pay attention to what's going on, because then you can start to make those choices that are going to align with getting those needs met.
Yeah. It's like, get off the hamster wheel.
That's right.
Take a breath.
Yep.
Step back and then take a deep dive into it.
That's
back.
Right.
Look. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really, to me, it's that simple, but it's not so simple. So what would you tell people who are like, I don't know how to be present? I'm sure you get that all the time. Like, I don't want to be present. I hear it all the time too. So what advice do you have for our listeners?
So that is where I will often come back to a meditation practice, getting into an actual meditation practice. And when I teach meditation, I always start with saying, this is what mindfulness is, and this is what meditation is. And they're not synonyms, even though they're often used very synonymously. Yeah. Meditation is a practice. It is a thing that you do that will help you become more mindful, which is a way that you are. And so that's kind of the directionality of that relationship. But I do think that having a seated meditation practice helps us reduce the distraction. It helps us learn what our brain wants to do when it's left to its own devices. We get to just sort of observe, how do our thoughts work? How does our body feel? We can lower some of the outside noise. We can lower some of the inside noise. Like, I have a very loud brain. And so meditation really helps me kind of bring that to a quieter place so I can, you know, just sort of pay attention to what's going on. It has really helped me get back in my body, reconnect with my body, be able to kind of recognize the signs that it's giving me, the things, you know, that my body will communicate to me. And so through all of that practice, I've really learned how to then be mindful in daily living.
Yeah. And I'm sure as you get deeper into your meditation practice, you start to learn a lot about yourself.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
A lot about yourself.
For good. Yeah. For good and for bad. Yeah. Some of those lessons are
hard. They're all good. It's all good. It's lessons. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Sometimes you're going to be faced with some things. That's right. But you'll be faced with some things that you'll need to reconcile with, you know, and to be able to say like, oh, I didn't realize that I had that tendency and I don't, you know, necessarily prefer to keep it. And so sometimes you're gonna have to reckon with yourself, but I do think it all leads to good in the end. You know, that there's a lot of really bold self-acceptance in that practice and in being able to really sit with yourself. But I like using it even just, you know, this idea of, can I put myself in a position that's uncomfortable and tolerate it? Because I think one of our societal concerns collectively is an aversion to discomfort. Wow. We are a society. And I think that might go back to your earlier point, which is we have a lot of privilege to be able to put ourselves into very comfortable positions whenever we want to. Right. And so we've sort of lost the capability of being uncomfortable. And so I really like a seated meditation practice just for that. Your back hurts because you're sitting upright in a way that you might not normally sit. Maybe something itches. Maybe there's a distraction in your environment. Maybe you're trying to meditate and your family members or the people that you cohabitate with are being louder than you wish you were. Great. Let all of that happen. Can you still stay in yourself while all that other stuff is going on and not feel the need to just like blindly and habitually react to it, but to approach more of a response of, what do I want to do right now? Do I need to react to this? Because sometimes the answer is no. And we live in a very like, you know, immediate demand response kind of
instant gratification.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. And so sometimes the seated meditation could just really help you build that question and answer of, you know, do I need to do anything about this right now? Or is it just uncomfortable? I love the phrase of, you know, it might hurt, but it's not hurting you. Right. And not to say like that we want to, you know, invite in pain, but something might be uncomfortable and that can just be okay. Like that phrase, this is uncomfortable, could be a neutral statement. We've just assigned a lot of negative connotation to the word uncomfortable. But what if we just approach that like it's neutral? Like it is just uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Okay. It won't be this way forever. Just right. Let it be, you know.
Right. And it's so hard for us because, I mean, it's like we have a headache. We pop, there's a pill for that.
Yep. Yep.
We pop that. I can go down the whole pharmaceutical thing for like days, but
I would be right there with you.
we don't have funds for something. Instead of being patient, we go get a loan.
Right. Yep. Or a credit card. Yep.
A credit card. Or mm-hmm. we have an immediate solution to it.
Yeah.
Instead of sitting. And I think meditation, where for me, it's caused so much more patience.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Within situations, because you have to practice patience.
Yep.
When you're doing it, especially with the million distractions that you get interrupted with.
Yeah. And it's really helped, like in my life, I see where it has helped me be so much more compassionate to myself when I'm responding to something in a way that I wish I wasn't. Yeah. You know, so if I get frustrated with my kids or with my partner, to just be able to just say, well, what, you know, gently ask, I wonder what that might be about, right? Like, I love this idea of curiosity. Like, I wonder if we could start more sentences with the phrase, I wonder, I think it would like really fix a lot of the things that our society struggles with. And so, you know, I can apply that to myself and just be like, oh, I wonder why I might be feeling this way, or I wonder why I responded this way, or I wonder why this is coming up for me. And then that just opens up the door for more compassionate responses, because now it's not about that self-blame or self-judgment or being just blindly angry at other people and you can't quite figure out why. It just gives you that opportunity to be like, oh, I wonder what might be going on here.
Yeah. It's giving yourself grace too.
For sure. Yep. So much. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So strengthening relationships often involves addressing codependent behaviors. How do you approach the sensitive topic with couples in small groups? And then what steps do you suggest to reduce these behaviors?
Mm-hmm. So this is deep. This could probably be its whole own episode. But I approach codependency through a kind of a four-pronged viewpoint. Okay. So the way that I look at it when I work with couples or if I'm teaching it is looking at attachment. So what did our earliest caregiving experiences look like, and how did that then create attachment needs in ourselves or potentially attachment wounds? So most people fall into either anxious, avoidant, disorganized, or secure attachment. And most people fall into the first three, right? Like secure attachment it feels to me like it takes some work. And I feel like people are generally not inclined to arrive into adulthood with secure attachment. But looking, if we just want to take the first two and say avoidant or anxious, disorganized is a mixture of the first two. So they're all kind of related, but, you know, looking at our attachment wounds, our attachment needs, and the ways that our attachment style shows up in our relationships. So somebody with anxious attachment might be hypervigilant. They might be very worried about their partner leaving them. They might take these kind of drastic steps to sort of prevent that, just really be very anxious about the nature of the relationship. Where avoidant folks tend to kind of shut down. They want to, you know, be a little bit isolated, or they'll keep partners at arm's length. There's always like this distance. They don't really let you in. Interestingly, these two attachment styles tend to be attracted to each other. So you've got somebody who's like, don't leave me, don't leave me, don't leave me. And this other person saying, no, 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 don't get too close. Don't get too close. And so, you know, disaster ensues. And that's a really common attachment dynamic. Yeah. So I always kind of want to start there with a couple and talk about getting to know your own attachment style, understand your partner's attachment style, and really do a lot of psychoeducation around the way those things show up. And then the next step for me is talking about nervous system activation and this idea of sitting with discomfort, because then the third angle is boundaries. So being able to set really loving, flexible, gentle, but firm boundaries with yourself and with each other, to build that interdependence so that you are connected and you're sharing a life and you're sharing experiences, but you are independently whole and healthy. Yeah. And it's kind of supplementing each other instead of completing each other. I really, really hate the whole Jerry Maguire thing.
Oh, anybody, yes.
The Gen Xers know, you complete me. Like, I feel like that messed up an entire generation when it came to this idea of what a relationship should be. Yeah. Right. And so helping couples learn to set some boundaries with themselves and with each other can really reduce the codependent behaviors, build some interdependence. But we have to really look at the nervous system part with that, because when our attachment wounds are being reactivated, it's going to create a nervous system response. And we need to be able to understand that, recognize what's happening, see it for what it is, and self-soothe through it so that we don't just continuously fall into these repetitious patterns of behavior. We get to say, okay, I can feel the tension in my body right now because my partner said that they wanted to spend some time with their friends. That activates my wound. I feel afraid. I can communicate this effectively with my partner. So now you can have a conversation. You can be thoughtful. You can express your needs. They can respond to those needs in whatever way they want to. It doesn't have to be now a fight or sabotaging behaviors or anything. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't have to like fall down that that hole that yeah. That pit of nonsense that couples very often will find themselves in. But I feel like all of that has to sort of happen together. And then the fourth part of my model is to really work on communication skills. So being able to articulate when this happens, I feel such, you know, and being able to just really bring in some strong fundamental communication skills so that people can say what they need to say, be heard, respond appropriately.
So let's talk about codependency a little bit.
What are
some key, let's go into internally for a person. What are some key things they need to look at within themselves, because everybody's like, I'm not codependent. Everybody's so independent. But in a sense, a majority of people are codependent.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree.
Some things to look like, I don't want to call them red flags within yourself, but what are some things that you need to look into, like alert, like, hey, you might want to look into getting some help with this.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think codependency and people pleasing are pretty synonymous in my perspective. It's just, when we're talking about codependency, we're generally talking about family systems or couple systems, and people pleasing is more society writ large. You know, we can be people pleasers in a variety of different relationships. I often find people are a little bit more easily able to recognize their people pleasing tendencies mm-hmm. than their codependent tendencies. And so I would say, if you're a people pleaser, there's a really good chance your relationships have some codependence in them, right? And so that would be one of the first things I would be looking at. Really, any patterns of behavior where you are unable to access happiness if the people around you are unhappy, if you find it really difficult to tolerate somebody's disappointment or even perceived disappointment. I know some patterns of behavior that I've struggled with is the, are you mad at me? Are you mad at me? One of my favorite memes is, there's an Alice in Wonderland illustration, and the Cheshire Cat is up in the tree, and he's saying the line from the book, "We're all mad here." And Alice is standing at the ground looking up at him, and she goes, "At me?" And if you connect with that meme, you might be codependent or just have some of those tendencies.
Yeah.
So really, those patterns of behavior, because that, at its core, what codependency is suggesting is that you can't be okay if your people are not okay, in a way that is beyond compassion and empathy, and I would like to be able to take care of people I love. But this whole, your value, your whole sense of self rides on, is my partner okay? Is my parent okay? Is my child okay? Those are the types of things that we would really be looking for. Self-sacrificial. I think the whole moms are so selfless trope is harmful. I think mothers need to have boundaries with their families, right? And we do this whole like, oh, moms are so selfless, like that's a good thing. And I'm like, no, that's actually not a good thing. Like, you know, I think the aim and the attempt to be a good parent is wonderful, but you need to take time and space for yourself. You need to be able to tolerate the displeasure of the people around you. You need to learn to be okay with that discomfort.
Yeah.
Sometimes people are going to be mad. Sometimes you're going to disappoint somebody. Sometimes they're not going to like the choices you made. Okay. It's going to be hard. It's going to feel like shit inside.
Yeah.
Take care of yourself. Yes. Soothe yourself through that discomfort so that you can respond behaviorally in a different way.
So what kind of tips do you have for moms that might be struggling with this?
Yes.
I know, I'm a mom of older children. I've been there. However, I have lots of friends who they struggle. They're stay at home moms, and they're struggling. They're like, mm-hmm. you know, my husband does all the stuff, and I'm supposed to be like on top of stuff. And I'm like, your cup is this full.
Yeah.
You're trying to fill everyone else's cup, and it's just not going to happen. So
yeah. Yeah. And that's often where I'll start, is just kind of breaking down that myth of you need to pour yourself empty in order to qualify as being a good mother. Right. And I love to just remind moms that I work with, like, you can love your people better with a full cup. And so if your whole argument against taking time away, doing things for yourself, scheduling time alone is guilt, let me tell you, you got a lot more to feel guilty about if you are depleted, because now you really can't do anything good for your family at all, because you're now a hollow shell of a human. So just constantly just refuting that myth. But I do think it's important. I mean, we can come back to the Maslowian hierarchy, right? Are you nourished? Like, I can remember my kids were toddlers. My kids are 16 months apart, and my older child has a developmental disability. So their baby years, toddler years, a lot of hands-on. It was very, very challenging. I was working part-time, but spent most of my time home with them. And I can remember my lunch would sometimes be whatever they didn't finish, right? Like whatever on their plate, they, and I'm like, you know, eating like tiny little quartered chicken nuggets.
Yeah.
No, make yourself lunch, right? Drink water. Yeah. Get some sleep. I think holding our partners accountable is a huge part of it. And so if you feel like the caretaking is really lopsided in your home, addressing that with your partner as best as you're able to, because I do think that that's a huge concern, is that not all partnerships are equitable in that care. And so advocating for yourself, and it's really hard, but I think in the long run, it's better for everybody to be able to say those things. But, you know, looking at time and relationship, you know, are you doing things outside of your home? And it will feel incredibly uncomfortable, but I think it's really important to, you know, to do it and hold yourself gently in that discomfort, but don't let it stop you.
And it's almost setting up an example for your children too.
100%.
Because if you're not taking care of yourself,
yeah,
it's showing that your children will, you're not allowed to be worthy enough to right. have time for yourself.
Right, right. So I think it shapes their ability to know that it's okay to prioritize your own care, right? So now we're empowering our children to be able to take good care of themselves. But it's also, they will very likely one day be parents and partners. And so it's helping us break cycles. The next generation of moms might not feel this level of burden. You know, I really look at it through this lens, and I read this somewhere. I didn't come up with this idea all by myself, but I don't remember where I read it to properly cite it. But this idea of, you know, Gen X women, which is where I fall, like we were told you can have it all, but like nobody told us how.
Right.
Right. And it was this idea of like, you can go to college and you can have a career and you can be a C-suite executive, but we're not going to take anything off your other plate at home. Right. And so we were given a little bit of a lie.
Super mom syndrome here.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so I think, you know, for those of us that are in this cohort or even elder millennials at this point, like really looking at how do we break that fallacy down, and recognize that it maybe we don't always need to have it all, or maybe we need to ask more of our partners so that they can also be having it all, right? Like they can be a great parent, you know, they can be a great dad and a successful businessman. You know, I remember I was in grad school getting my master's when I was pregnant with my first child. And so many people would ask me like, are you going to stay home after the baby is born? And I'm like, I just spent $60,000 in 3 years getting a master's degree. And nobody asked the father of my children, my ex-husband, nobody asked him, not one time. Did anybody ask him, are you going to stay home when the kids are born? Right. And I'm like, if we could just start there, if we could stop calling it babysitting. Right. And that was not like my ex-husband, like he never called it babysitting ever. Right. And he actually desperately wanted to be a stay-at-home dad.
A lot of them probably do.
Yeah, no, he was very vocal. He would have done it in a minute if our financial situation could have justified that. But he just was in a different field than me and so earned more. But, you know, I can remember my first full-time job when my kids were toddlers. I did a lot of networking, and I would be at these like evening events and people would say like, oh, who's babysitting your kids? Your husband? And I was like, no, like, I mean, he's just being like the parent. he's just the parent at home right now. Like that's not babysitting.
Time with his own children.
Exactly. Like, I'm not even going to pay him like a babysitter you pay, like he's not going to pay.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Just, you know, thinking about those types of things when you encounter those, challenging them, you know, when you encounter them, you know, people are asking just kind of, you know, silly questions that reinforce gender stereotypes, push back on that a little bit.
Yeah. And then just knowing that they're not doing it to be typically condescending. It's just
right.
The way that they think and they're raised and they exactly. haven't gone out of that. So it really does take, you know, the questioning and like the pushing back on it to really get them to think about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. And I always did it with a lot of humor. you know, I wasn't trying to make anybody feel bad or pick a fight, but just like, you know, no. And I would say all the time, like, no, he's not babysitting. I pay my babysitters. He's just home. Yeah. Like, you know, so you like, pay him. Exactly. You know, so it was joking and it was lighthearted, but it was intentional. Like, I'm going to push back of this idea that you think a dad at home with his kids is babysitting.
Yeah. So, good for you. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the Hudson Valley is known for its natural beauty.
Yes.
How do you find that living in this area influences your practice of reading, hiking, cycling, and practicing yoga? And how do you incorporate these activities into your holistic approach to well-being?
Yeah, it is the thing that keeps me sane. It is how I fill my cup. Those are all the things that I do to keep my cup full so that I can take good care of my family and my clients and myself. I really have found nature to be a spiritual experience. And so it's extremely fulfilling to me in that way. You know, I find like this time of year, all of the earliest little signs of spring are coming out. And that to me, I get very excited, like a little kid. You know, we were out walking the dog a couple of days ago and we have a neighbor who's got snowdrops coming up in their yard and down the street, another yard looks like maybe some tulip shoots might be just starting to poke through. And I, you know, I can't not point it out. I'm like, look, you know, I'm very, very excited. So I find a lot of, you know, a real spiritual experience of being outside. It's also really good for us. Movement is so good for our bodies. Sunlight, movement, and fresh air is really good for our brain chemistry. And so, you know, getting outside, even if it's just, you know, walk around your block if you're able, but just to kind of get outside. I often point to the fact that I have a dog as such a wonderful mental health companion because I take her out. I mean, she needs a walk every day. Yeah. So even when it's cold, you know, I'm still outside. And I think that that's one of the misconceptions about wintertime, particularly in the Northeast, is that, oh, it's too cold to be out. It's gross. It's gray. Yeah. It's not really, you know, people are always like, I only want to be outside if it's nice weather. But it's going to have a good impact, even if you are all bundled up and, you know, it's a little chilly outside. You're still getting fresh air. You're still moving your body. You're still getting some sunshine, even if it's December sunshine versus August sunshine. It still counts, you know? And so, I find it to just be a wonderful restorative practice to be able to be outside, and the Hudson Valley is gorgeous. Anybody that has never visited here, we're about 90 miles northwest of Manhattan. It's absolutely stunning. I feel like one of the luckiest people in the world, to be able to live where I live, where I exactly live right now. I only live here because I got divorced and then went on a dating app and then met a guy. he brought me to where he lived. So my kids and I moved in with him about 7 years ago. And I always say that I think one of the biggest things that I fell in love with about him was where he brought, like, I feel like he brought me home. Like, this is just where we live. It's just such a beautiful spot. We're kind of nestled in, right in between like the Pocono and the Catskill mountain ranges. If people are at all familiar with that, I'm about 45 minutes to an hour from one strip of the Appalachian Trail. So, I mean, we're like an hour and a half from the Berkshire. So we're like in a pretty mountainous region. And so lots of great hiking and trails, and it's a real spirit for outdoors. There's a lot of accessibility here, rail trails everywhere. It's just really lovely. We're very fortunate.
Yeah. Sounds like a very grounding place.
It really is. It really, really is. It makes me happy.
Yeah. That's awesome. I love the beach. So where I'm in Florida, like, by okay. The beach, but yeah, I like, then my heart's like, man, I could do some mountains. There's like no mountains in Florida. It's like, that's like a 12-hour drive. So
Yeah.
I think the fact that you get, the mountains too.
I was going to say, I think the probably the closest beach, maybe two and a half hours. I think we can make it to Jones Beach, Long Island, maybe 2.5 hours from here. Maybe not quite that far, but it's not too bad. We can get to the beach relatively easy. And we've got a lot of lakes, so we don't have ocean beaches nearby, but we've got a lot of lake beaches, where I live, which is also nice. It's still sand. It's still fresh water.
That sounds awesome. I'm going to have to put that on my list because I haven't been yet.
So it's great. It's great.
You sold me.
Yeah.
Probably all the listeners too. They're like, we're booking our flight now.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my gosh. There was such a mass exodus here during COVID. So many people left the city. Moved up here. So there was a huge explosion in population over the last 4 years. Yeah. A lot more people know where the Hudson Valley is now.
That's such a secret now.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. So you mentioned curiosity and gratitude as essential tools for well-being. Can you elaborate on how these qualities contribute to meaning-making and overall mental health?
Yeah. I point to gratitude practice specifically as probably the most life-changing thing I've ever adopted, for lack of a better word. And it was always sort of something I dabbled with. You know, I would make Thanksgiving lists, you know, things I'm thankful for. But it took on a different, different meaning and a different role in my life during the period where I was getting divorced. When I first separated from my ex-husband, I took very little from our home. I moved out. He stayed in the house with the kids. I took very, very few possessions with me. It felt like I needed to do that, that it needed to kind of be the stripped down deconstruction of who I had been, and an opportunity to kind of figure out who I wanted to be moving forward. And maybe that first year that I was out of that house, I got an apartment, and then I was able to get a slightly bigger apartment, and I needed to furnish it. I needed to build a house or a home, you know, for my kids and I to live in. And I remember probably about a year, year and a half after separating and sitting in the living room in my apartment and looking around, and it was fully furnished. I had a bed from a friend. I had a kitchen table from another friend. I had a couch from my boss. I had bunk beds that I found on Craigslist. And when I reached out to the guy to ask about buying them, he basically was like, I bought these, you know, 4 or 5 years ago when I separated from my ex-wife, so that my kids had a place when they were here. So he knocked the price off and delivered them to my apartment for me. Like, just all these little gifts from the universe. And I can just remember like sitting on the floor in my living room and looking around and being like, I built this life because the universe was so kind to me, like just literally just put all these things in my way. And I surrounded me with these people that just showed up for me in such a profound way. And that kind of ignited this idea of like, there's just so much to be grateful for. And that became then a real intentional practice. And the thing I always say is that when I started out saying, I want to intentionally know gratitude and experience gratitude for the ways that the universe is benevolent in my life, you can't not find it, right? Like, then it's everywhere, right? And so that to me is why the direct thread of that is why when I'm walking down my road, walking the dog, I notice the snowdrops. I notice the green buds because I'm constantly looking for it, because it's a part of that practice to be able to see the good things in my life and name them out loud and be mindfully present with them, right? It's all coming together.
Okay, right? Going back to the mindfulness.
Exactly. Yes. Like just being awake and aware in my life. Like if you're going to have a consistent daily gratitude practice, like I advocate for, you have to be mindful throughout your entire day so that you have things to then write down before you go to bed at night. And so it all kind of comes together in a really profound way. And I really think that curiosity and gratitude for me go hand in hand. So I started this practice with this idea of gratitude, but what I ended up experiencing was also curiosity. And it's this overlap. I think that overlap between gratitude and curiosity is awe, right? This experience of awe. Awe is that feeling that we get when we recognize how vast everything is and how small we are, which then makes us feel really powerful, right? So it's like this weird, like this weird recognition of like, oh, you're so small and insignificant, but to know that and be like celebratory of that is such a huge expansive feeling. So it's like this, I don't know, weird kind of duality, but that's really where it came in for me. So this idea of awe led in certain ways to curiosity, of that idea of like, I wonder, and like, you know, when I go outside and I can see all the stars, like there's this gratitude of like, oh, that's so beautiful. And then immediately like, but what constellation is that? And so I get out my little app and I'm pointing it up at the sky. Yeah. I'm like, oh, that's Cassiopeia. Or, oh, that's the Big Dipper. Or, oh, you know, I'll see something real bright and I'll be like, I bet that's a planet. And so then, oh, that's Venus or that's Jupiter. Anytime I can spot a planet from my front porch is like the most profound. Yes, 100%. Immediately, I'm like, that's amazing. Like I'm standing on my front porch in New York and I'm spotting Jupiter. Like, how do you not just feel great? And like, to me, I'm like, that's amazing. And so that's kind of where they all kind of come in for me. And it just, I don't know, it just sort of sets a mindset of life is really magnificent. And yeah, there are heaping piles of shit everywhere and things are really hard. And also, you can stand on your front porch and peep a planet. And that to me, I'm just like, yep, okay. Let's hold them both.
Yeah. The more that I feel like it goes back to, though, if you're looking for the negativity, you're going to find it.
Oh, you sure are.
If you're looking for the positivity, you are going to find it. And it's just that quick.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's literally, you can switch it that quick.
Yeah. And I always love to reference Viktor Frankl, who wrote Man's Search for Meaning. And he was credited with kind of founding the school of existential psychology, which can have a lot of nihilistic doom and gloom components to it, right? I mean, basically, it's like, we're all going to die. Like, that's kind of the core of existentialism is we're all going to die. But one of the things I really love about Viktor Frankl's work, because I get really frustrated with the toxic positivity zeitgeist of the moment, you know, hashtags good vibes only sort of makes me ragey, because I think that's really harmful because it's so dismissive of the fact that things can be really difficult, right? And people are struggling with really big issues and our world is really in crisis in so many ways and there is so much suffering. And so one of the things that Viktor Frankl writes about is called tragic optimism, which is this idea of everything can be a flaming hot mess and you can be okay. And that to me is the key to all of that, because I never want to come across as, you know, positively or toxically positive, because I do think that undercuts people's lived experiences and can be very, just really kind of steeped in privilege and short-sighted. But yeah. I do think that even when things are falling apart, there can be that place of peace, that place of completeness within you that is resilient against all of those challenges. And that's where happiness can live.
Yeah. So when we're so there's, I love that you pointed that out, because in order to be authentic in our feelings and our emotions and everything, which is the most important thing, in my opinion,
same,
we can't be toxically positive all right. The time. It's not always cupcakes and rainbows. And it's like I tell my clients, like, you're like feeling like, okay, on the scale of 1 to 10, you're at a 3.
Yeah.
You cannot go from 3 to 10 without going all the way up the chain.
Right.
It's just not going to authentically happen. And then you're shoving those emotions back down. You're not dealing with anything.
Right. Right.
So I love that you address that. It's such importance. So important. And to me, it's like a fine line of the, you don't want to stay in the negativity. But if you have a bad day, own it. You have a bad day. You have a shit day, you have a shit day.
That's right.
That's what it is. Doesn't mean tomorrow's going to be the same.
Right. And I think by owning it, like, that's how we can comfort ourselves through it too, right? Like, there's a lot of healing in that.
Yeah.
I like to use the phrase both and, you know. In Buddhism, we call it the tension of opposites, which is this idea that two seemingly contradictory things can be true at the same time. We can recognize that the world is in crisis, and we can find joy in the little quiet moments. They're both true.
Yeah.
And I think once we can reconcile to that, everything else becomes a little bit easier to wrap our brains around.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. So I'm going to end on this. For listeners looking to embark on their own journey towards mindful well-being, what final steps would you recommend to foster a more mindful, grateful, and meaningful life?
Yeah. So meditate, even if it's 2 minutes every day. Even if you're listening to a guided meditation, people have so many weird rules about meditation. None of them are true.
Right. I agree. You
know, people are like, I have to meditate for a half hour in silence. And I'm like, nope, you can meditate for 2 minutes listening to a guided meditation, sitting on your couch.
Yeah.
Wherever you are, let the practice meet you there, but do it, because I really do think it'll make a change. It will change your brain chemistry. I promise, like 100%. I always advocate for a written gratitude practice. You know, write it down. There's something about writing something down that solidifies it in our own neurology. And so engaging with that practice every day is going to help you start to view things through a different lens, and it's going to have a really positive impact on your emotional state. It's going to help build resilience, and really can have a profound difference on your overall mental health. And yeah, check out Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Super simple. But it's a great framework if you're not sure where to start. You know, and just really look at where can you start to make small changes. You don't have to overhaul your whole life immediately, but are there one or two things that you could start doing differently right now? And if there are, go ahead and start there. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. It can be teeny tiny little changes, just making the steps along the way, but it'll start to accumulate.
Well, thank you so much, Courtney. All of Courtney's information is going to be in the show notes, link to her own podcast.
Yes.
And links to where you can reach out and contact her for any questions as well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you so much. It's been great.
Yeah, this is wonderful. Thank you.